Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to the program today. My guest is Bruce Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Between 1983 and 1998, Bruce was a state coordinator of the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice and has worked on space issues for 27 years. In 1987, he organized the largest peace protest in Florida history when over 5,000 people marched on Cape Canaveral in opposition to the first flight test of the Trident II nuclear missile. He was the organizer of the Cancel Cassini campaign. The Cassini campaign was a project that launched 72 pounds of plutonium into space in 1997. The Cancel Cassini campaign drew enormous support and media coverage around the world and was featured on the TV program 60 Minutes. Project Censored from Sonoma State University in California named a story on space weaponization by Bruce Gagnon as the eighth most censored story in 1999. Again, in 2005, Project Censored picked an article on space issues by Bruce as the 16th most censored story of the year. Bruce has spoken on many college campuses and in 2003 was appointed as senior fellow at the Nuclear Policy Research Institute. In 2006, he was the recipient of the Dr. Benjamin Spock Peacemaker Award. Bruce Gagnon, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
It's great to be with you, Helen.
Thank you, Bruce. Now, look, I'm fascinated by who you really are. Can we start off with that? I believe you came from a Republican family and you're in the Air Force. Tell us about that, Bruce.
Well, yeah, that's right. Actually, I grew up in an Air Force family. My dad was in the military and we moved all over the world, living on military bases behind the barbed wire fences. And then in 1968, we were living up in the panhandle of Florida, where, you know, they say it's so conservative, they call it Lower Alabama.
Yeah.
And it was that year in 68 that I worked as the vice chair of the Okaloosa County, Florida Young Republican Club, working on the Nixon campaign.
Mm.
And in fact, I did such a good job working on the campaign, they had a fish fry fundraiser right before the election. And they asked me to sit at the head table with their guest speaker that night. You might remember former Senator Strom Thurmond from South Carolina.
I sure do.
So that's how I got started. And then in 1971, just out of high school, I tried to join the Air Force, but actually flunked my induction physical because of an old high school football injury. And I had to get a waiver to get into the military, when most people of good sense were trying to stay out because of the Vietnam War. But it was there, in the military, in the Air Force, that I became a peace activist as I began to realize what the United States was really all about in Vietnam.
What specific things did you realize as a very young man when you were in the Air Force?
Well, you know, all the contradictions about we're over there for democracy, and I was stationed at a base in California that was an airlift base for the war. And soldiers would come from all over America to get on the planes to go to Vietnam. And when the planes would return, they would bring the body bags of the dead soldiers.
Oh.
And so they would be lined up just right across the street from where I worked on a daily basis.
Oh.
And that just kind of began a process in me of change.
Oh. Well, you certainly had a profound impact on me, Bruce. I think you invited me down to Florida to speak, and there I learnt about America's plans to put weapons in space and fight war from space down to Earth. That's
right.
Correct, isn't it?
You came before the Cassini launch to help us build opposition to the launching of plutonium into space. And during that time, driving all over Central Florida, we had many chances to talk about space, and you really were paying attention.
I was absolutely shocked to the back teeth. Now, first, let's talk about Cassini. What was it, and where did it go, and the slingshot, and then we'll talk about plutonium.
Cassini was like many other of the NASA plutonium space missions. It was a deep space mission going way out into deep space. They said they had to use plutonium on board in order to create the onboard electricity, because solar, NASA said, would not work in deep space.
What was it going to do in deep space, Cassini?
Oh, it was going to orbit Jupiter and send back pictures, you know, as they often do with these missions. In 1989, there was a launch called Galileo. In 1990, there was another one called Ulysses. And then in 1997, there was Cassini. All of them going to deep space to take pictures, to look at planets, to send back information, scientific information. We weren't opposed to the missions in and of themselves. We were just opposed to the use of plutonium on board. And what most people don't understand is it's not only the launch, of course, that we're very concerned about, that there could be a launch pad explosion. In fact, in NASA's environmental impact statement for the Cassini mission, they acknowledge that if there was a launch explosion and a release of the plutonium as dust, that they would have a 60-mile radius area that would be affected, because the winds would carry the plutonium dust for 60 miles. And in their EIS, they said they would have to go out and remove all the people, remove all the buildings, remove all the vegetation, remove all the animals. Can you imagine the fish, the birds, the butterflies, the alligators, the snakes? It's just impossible. Then they'd have to remove the top layer of soil, and everything would be radioactive for thousands of years. Well, we saw what happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. They couldn't deal with that. How are they going to deal with a 60-mile radius nuclear contamination zone in the middle of Florida? It's pure insanity. But in addition to the launch problems, there's the whole problem of manufacturing the plutonium generators at the Department of Energy laboratories that you are very familiar with, the long, sordid history that DOE has of contaminating workers, contaminating communities, air, water. Well, just prior to the launch of Cassini, the Santa Fe, New Mexico newspaper ran a story saying that 244 cases of worker contamination were reported as they were fabricating the plutonium generators for that particular mission.
It was plutonium-238, which is more toxic than plutonium-239. 239 is what is used as fuel for bombs, and its half-life is 24,400 years. But 238, I can't remember, it's got a shorter half-life than 239, more energetic, much more carcinogenic, right, Bruce?
That's right. And that's why they use it, because it generates more onboard heat, more onboard electricity for the spaceships. And then finally, the Air Force, the military, has been saying for a long time that to successfully power weapons in space, things like the space-based laser and other orbiting battle stations that they dream of in the future, that they would need nuclear reactors in space for those missions in order to generate the power to fire weapons in space. And so we have always said that missions like Cassini and the other nuclear missions are really icebreakers to get everyone used to the idea of launching nuclear power in space, so that someday when they wanted to use it for weapons technology, it would no longer, quote unquote, be an issue. So this was one of the major motivators of our efforts to organize opposition to those missions. And now, still today, the nuclear industry views space as a market for their product. They want to put nuclear-powered mining colonies on the Moon and Mars and other planetary bodies as they inevitably move off this planet to do resource extraction on those outer planetary bodies. So there's a whole host of these nuclear missions planned in the coming years.
Talk about the toxicity of plutonium-238 to human beings, Bruce, and also talk about the slingshot and how extraordinarily dangerous that was of the Cassini mission.
Well, the idea of the slingshot, that in order to get it way out into deep space, they wanted to whip it around the Earth, so they were going to launch it, send it off into space, and then have it come hurtling back towards Earth, and then whip around the Earth itself using the gravity of Earth in order to slingshot it way out into deep space. The concern was that as it came hurtling back towards Earth, if there was a malfunction of their rockets as they were doing their maneuver around the planet, it could be sucked back in by Earth gravity, burn up on reentry, and spread the plutonium globally. In fact, prior to the launch of Cassini, we got a phone call from a person working at a aerospace corporation that said that in the laboratory they had a 10% failure rate of the rocket engines for the Cassini mission. He said, you know, when you go with the lowest bidder on these components for these missions, you know, you're going to get garbage. And so, we were able actually to force NASA. Originally, they wanted to come in about 250 miles off Earth's surface with the slingshot. We were able, through our organizing around the world, force them to move out to about 500 miles, so there was less of a chance that that it could fall back into Earth. But to answer your question, I always use actually one of your stories that I thought was most illustrative of the danger of the Cassini mission and the launching of plutonium in space. You have long said that it would only take a very, very small dose of plutonium, basically a piece of dust, to
a millionth of a gram,
to give everyone a lethal dose, and that it would only take theoretically 1 pound to give every single person on the planet a lethal dose. So I always talked about it like a Catholic priest going down a line, giving people communion. You know, it would just be a tiny little speck that would then get into the body, where it would be passed on through our reproductive organs, and that people would be exposed to various forms of cancer over time. I know you know a lot more about this than I do.
And it was 1998, wasn't it? And they went ahead and did it, right?
97.
Yeah, well, thank God it didn't burn up in space. But as you say, they've got lots more plans. So, Bruce Gagnon, let's move on then to what's actually happening now in space. I want to talk about first the weaponization of space, and then we'll get into this missile defense controversy, so-called, and talk about President Obama's latest moves, both on missile defense and on possibly the reduction of nuclear weapons in the world. So let's now talk about the weaponization of space and where that stands at the moment, and who are the corporations behind this, Bruce Gagnon?
Well, the key corporations are Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing. They're the top three. And then there's a whole host of smaller subcontractors and other corporations that are involved. But those are the top ones.
And Northrop Grumman?
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's many, many of them, but the top three are those.
Yep.
They each have various responsibilities in the in developing the technologies. I think the most important point I could make about space warfare technology today is that they are in this total period of experimentation. They say over and over again at the Pentagon, at what's called the Missile Defense Agency, that gets about $10 billion a year of your hard-earned tax dollars, to do research and development on these technologies. And they say over and over again that, look, we know we're not going to get all of these different technologies to work, but if we spend enough money over a long enough period of time, we will get enough technologies to work that will enable us to control and dominate space. And most importantly of all, they say, deny other countries access to space. And in fact, at the Air Force Space Command headquarters in Colorado Springs, on the headquarters building, they have their logo that reads Master of Space. So they've been talking this kind of language for many years, since the Space Command was created by the Pentagon as a new military command.
When was the Space Command created, Bruce?
I want to say 92, but I'm afraid that number is slipping my mind right now. I'm not really sure, but it was in the early 90s. Mm. Anyway, so today they're developing many, many different technologies. The problem that they've come up with, though, today, that has really become a real impediment to them, is that they're realizing that when you start blowing things up in space, you create all kinds of space debris or space junk, which ultimately, as it grows and grows and grows, becomes like a minefield orbiting the planet, and that they fear, and many scientists are now confirming this, that at some point in time, if allowed to continue, this field of space debris or space junk would be so great that we would not be able to get a rocket off the planet Earth, that the human race would be entombed to the planet forever. So this is causing some adjustment on the part of the Space Command as they try to figure out how do you control space and dominate space and deny other countries access to space, but still not create this massive array of space junk. And so one of the new strategies that they're developing is called cyber warfare. The idea that before even launching an attack on someone, you crawl into their computer. You use satellites and computer technology to actually infiltrate the computer system of the enemy so that you can destroy their capability to protect themselves before you do an invasion of them. And so that's a whole new field of space technology warfare.
How would that work? I don't quite understand your drift, Bruce.
Well, let's use some illustrations.
Yeah.
When the U.S. launched the shock and awe invasion of Iraq in 2003, one of the first things that was done before any weapons were fired was that the Space Command began a process of essentially hacking the computers of Iraq, shutting down their air defense systems, going in and closing down their computer systems, so that once we did launch the invasion, the actual attack itself, they had much less of a chance to defend themselves.
How did they do that?
They like any hacker does these days, they use computers, satellite technology to essentially invade or crawl inside of the opponent's computer and then go in and shut it down. And so they were able to shut down basically the air defense system of Iraq using this process. And then following that, the attack began. Cruise missiles were fired from Aegis destroyers just off the coast of Iraq, and a whole array of other systems were used. And then in that attack, in the initial stages of the attack, 70% of the weapons that were used by the United States were directed and guided to their targets in Iraq by U.S. military satellites. And so the idea then is that if you have the ability to dominate space in this way, that you can use space technology to shut down the opponent's capabilities and then still use your space technology to be dominant in the attack. It's what they call full spectrum dominance.
Well, how do they use space? I suppose they use space with satellites to hack into the computers in Iraq.
It's all basically done using military satellite technology.
And
in the end,
and it would be also using Pine Gap, which is the biggest CIA base in the world, through which all these communications pass.
It would use
in the middle
stations
of Australia,
like Pine Gap in Australia. It would use Menwith Hill in England, Filing Dales up in northern England, and others that are stationed around the world. This is an important point you bring up. The United States, over the years, has set up a whole array of ground stations all over the planet, because as satellites, military satellites, orbit the Earth, they basically have to send signals and receive signals from the ground just below them. So in order to have global coverage, the U.S. has set up these listening posts or radar stations that are all part of this whole Star Wars program. We've set them up all over the planet. And that's actually how we were able to create the global network years ago, the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. When we built the organization, we did it by contacting the peace groups in these various countries around the world where these U.S. Star Wars listening posts were all set up. And so people in those countries knew about space technology, and they're saying, we don't want our country to be used by the United States to fight Star Wars. And so they're the organizations that have really made up the bulk of the global network.
It's really military colonization, isn't it, by the U.S.?
That's exactly what it is, high-tech military colonization.
Now, Bruce, let's talk about what actual weapons they're proposing to put into space, how they would work, how they would be powered, and what they would actually do.
Well, again, right now they're in flux. One of the programs, the space-based laser, for example, something that they had long been wanting to develop, they're having to reevaluate it now because its job would be to fire a laser through space powered with nuclear reactors and then knock out other countries' satellites. Now, you can imagine, though, when you do that, when you fire a laser and destroy someone's satellite, you're creating more space debris. Or another weapon system is the kinetic energy anti-satellite weapon. Kinetic energy just means one thing smashing into another. So a very rudimentary technology that exists today, the United States would fire this anti-satellite weapon and destroy another country's satellite. But again, you're breaking it up, creating a lot of space junk. So while the work on these technologies is not completely shut down, they're really saying, oh my God, we've got to come up with something new here because of this space debris problem. We can't keep making more space debris. And in fact, you might remember just a year or so ago, China blew up one of their own outdated military satellites with a kinetic energy anti-satellite weapon as a way to show the United States that two can play this game. We're not going to allow the United States to take control and domination of space. But that particular test was a major, major creator of more space debris. And ever since that time, the Pentagon has really been sort of freaking out, saying, oh, my God, what are we going to do now? Now what they're talking about is developing some weapons they're calling global strike weapons, weapons that would use space technology but deliver the attack in a first strike, and it would destroy another country's assets on the ground before they could use them. I'll illustrate this point. Every year for the past many years, all through Clinton and now through Bush and then now through Obama, the Space Command has annually been wargaming a first strike attack on China set in the year 2016.
Oh, really?
The first weapon that they use in that attack is what they call the military space plane, what some people are saying will be the successor to the shuttle. If you listen closely today, you hear a lot of talk, we have to get rid of the shuttle. It's an outdated technology. We need to replace it. Well, they're talking about replacing it with the military space plane that would take off like an airplane, go into space, and fly from essentially the United States to the other side of the world in 1 hour. And as it comes out of space, it would then drop a devastating first strike attack on China, who today admittedly has 20 nuclear missiles that are capable of hitting the west coast of the United States. Well, of course, we have a whole eons more nuclear
thousands.
Weapons of our own.
Thousands.
Thousands, right. So this system then uses space, of course, it uses space technology, uses satellites to direct it, to fly it, but ultimately it flies through space, but then it drops its attack on the land itself, on China.
Like a nuclear weapon?
It could be nuclear, it could be conventional.
Mm.
And so anyway, in this war game set in the year 2016, that's what starts the attack. And then after the United States launches this attack on China, this first strike attack, trying to take out as many of their 20 nuclear missiles that are capable of hitting the west coast of the U.S., China then fires a retaliatory strike. And it is that time that the United States uses its so-called missile defense system. And this is where much of the space technology development work is going today, into so-called missile defense, which really has nothing to do with defense whatsoever. It is the shield that is used in the first strike attack after the sword is used in the first lunge. You know, the sword is used, the military space plane is the sword that attacks first, and then the missile defense shield is used as part of, an integral part of, the U.S. first strike attack system. So the global strike weapons and the so-called missile defense systems are really where a lot of the work is going today in the space technology field.
So, Bruce Gagnon, what you're really saying is because of the Chinese attack on their satellite and the creation of much more space debris, which of course threatens all the civilian uses of space for communications and global networks and ATM machines and cell phones and the like, the Space Warfare Department sort of freaked out and has decided that maybe they'll move into what you just described, the space-based plane, which would strike, say, China first, and then use missile defense. Have they moved their priorities into this direction? Is this what you're saying, or are they still working on weapons in space?
They still are working on weapons in space, but you see a greater emphasis.
Mm.
It might only be short term, but right now, for sure, if you look at the 2010 budget for Missile Defense Agency, the bulk of the money is going for the development of these newer systems. And they're moving, not completely shutting down again, not completely walking away from these other systems. But they're doing a lot of reevaluating and trying to come up with ways around this problem. Now, the other thing we've been trying to get people to see lately is that military satellites are weapons in space today. Again, let's use the illustration of the shock and awe invasion of Iraq in 2003. In the initial attack, 70% of the weapons that were used, the cruise missiles, other guided missiles, all different kind of weapon systems, were directed to their targets by space technology. Space satellites.
Smart weapons.
Exactly, so-called smart weapons. All must use military satellites in order to get to their targets.
Mm.
So the U.S. wants to make sure that no one else can do that. We have to still be able to deny other people access to space. We still have to be the master of space. But they're reconfiguring about how they're going to do that. And that means more technologies to do first strike land attacks. If you can blow up somebody's radar systems, if you can blow up their launch systems before they use them, then you're denying them access to space. So I think the emphasis is now going in that direction. But again, all of it is tied together by military satellites. Another illustration that I think is contemporary and important are the UAVs, the unmanned aerial vehicles, or drones, that are now being used by the U.S. in Afghanistan and Pakistan. These pilotless planes are being flown by pilots sitting at Creech Air Force Base outside of Las Vegas, Nevada, pilots sitting in Tucson, Arizona, at Air Force Base there, flying them, looking at a computer screen with a joystick hooked up to a satellite where they're flying these drones over Afghanistan or Pakistan. And they get the real-time, split-second-time images coming back from cameras mounted on these drones. They're looking at the screen. Is it Taliban? Is it Al-Qaeda? Is it a wedding? And in just a split second, they can make those predators or reapers, as they're called, fire missiles
reapers.
Mounted on board.
Isn't that disgusting? Reapers.
It's absolutely disgusting. And it really makes you wonder what it says about the soul of America.
Oh, I read a report where these people, military officers, sit at these consoles with their, you know, with their gear sticks and launch these weapons from the drones. And unlike pilots who just drop their bombs and fly away and never see the destruction, these people are actually seeing the body parts on the ground and, you know, weddings torn apart by their weapons, and they're having to have therapy, post-traumatic stress syndrome therapy, because they've never seen really before what they're actually doing.
That's right. That's right. On our website, the Global Network's website, which is spaceforpeace.org, spaceforpeace.org, we have a section called, in the menu, called Space Videos. And you can go there and you can watch some of these videos about these drones. But again, my point I wanted to make is that none of this is possible without these military satellites in space. And so they have become weapons in and of themselves because they are absolutely fundamentally crucial to tying the whole system together.
How many military satellites now in space does America have, Bruce Gagnon?
Oh, you know, I'm not, I don't know, but I would venture to guess more than 100. It's, and we're launching new ones all the time.
Are you?
Older ones go out of date, they shut down, they fall back to Earth, they burn up on reentry as they fall back to Earth, or they kick them into higher orbits, even farther up. But they're just constantly launching more of them. I don't know the exact number, but it is a lot. And I think an important point to make here is the sheer cost of space technology is unbelievable. Every one of these technology programs are 100, 200, 300, 400% over budget. Because you can imagine building these things is very expensive, but then you have to launch them. Sometimes they blow up on launch. You have to restart all over again and redo them. It is just enormous. And the Pentagon, you know, has long been bragging that Star Wars, the generic term for all of this, will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth. It's getting so expensive that U.S. by itself can't afford to pay for it, even after we're cutting social programs and trying to move the money into these developmental programs. So we're getting our allies, Japan, South Korea, Australia, Italy, England, Germany, other countries to come on board to help pay for these. And as they do this, and as I travel to these countries and talk to my friends, working in the peace movement, they're all telling the same story. Social spending, social progress in their country is now under attack in order to move money into these space technology programs.
What, Bruce, a couple of different questions. What powers the military satellites of America? And then let's talk about how much space debris is up there at the moment.
Most of the military satellites in space today are powered by solar devices.
Uh-huh.
In the early 60s, when the U.S. began launching them, they were using plutonium and uranium as power sources. In fact, one of the famous military satellites called SNAP-9A that fell back to Earth in 1962 or 63 had 2 pounds of plutonium on it and burned up on reentry. And as it burned up, the plutonium was spread globally. In fact, Dr. John Goffman, very famous
physician,
scientist,
yep.
he studied that particular accident and believes it's a major contributor to the increase in cancers around the earth today. And then Russia also was for many years using uranium and on their military satellites. And in fact, they still have 40 military satellites orbiting the earth today that are slowly decaying in orbit. And in fact, some of the uranium is being ejected from those satellites and is falling back to Earth. And they say that in the next 1,000 years, all 40 of those Russian military satellites with uranium on them will fall back to Earth.
Oh, God.
it's really tragic. It's the same old story, if you think about it. It's when the industrialization began on the planet. The big companies looked at rivers and lakes as vast and limitless. It didn't matter what you threw into them, industrial waste or whatever else. And it wasn't until years later that we began to realize that that they were polluting the water bodies and ultimately the people of the planet. Well, today, for the longest time, after the beginning of the dawn of the space age, the scientists and the militarists looked at space as vast and limitless. It didn't matter what we do up there. But now we're beginning to learn that we actually live in space. It's an environment that our Earth lives in, and that whatever we do in space will come back to haunt us here on the Earth.
Mm.
And they're just beginning to realize it. And as I said earlier, they're now having to make serious strategic adjustments because of the mess that they're already creating.
Okay, so how much space debris is up there greater than 1 centimeter in diameter, Bruce Gagnon?
Thousands and thousands of pieces, so much of it that NASA and the Space Command have to track it on big radar screens at the Space Command headquarters. And in fact, they've had to, on several occasions, move the International Space Station, for example, move it to another orbit because they were tracking space junk that was coming dangerously close. In fact, we all remember the Challenger, the space shuttle Challenger that blew up years ago with astronauts on board. On its previous mission, before it had its terrible accident, it had a windshield cracked when a tiny, tiny speck of paint orbiting the Earth at 15,000 miles an hour hit the windshield of the Challenger and cracked it. And if it had been something the size of your fist, it would have gone right through the Challenger and it would have been destroyed in orbit. So again, the fear is growing that there's going to be many people. In fact, I've seen scientists predict that the International Space Station will be destroyed before it's finished. It's not yet finished, and by space junk. So, and you know, it originally was going to cost us $10 billion, but here's an illustration of it, of the cost overruns on these programs. The price tag today has grown to $100 billion, and it's not yet finished.
And it really has no scientific purpose either. It's propaganda and publicity for NASA, as well as, you know, coordinating and communicating and working with the Russians and the like. But in fact, it has little science objectivity, right, Bruce, or purpose?
That's right. It has very little scientific usefulness.
Mm.
And in fact, we know that it's been a research platform for a lot of the space weapons technology development, a lot of the sensor testing and other testing of various components of a lot of these systems has been used. It's also been a way to put military satellites, warfighting satellites, into orbit. They often deliver them. It's really, as everything else at NASA now, everything at NASA is now dual use, they say, meaning every mission they fly at NASA is now both military and civilian at the same time. So the International Space Station, the Space Shuttle, all have long been had military application.
I'm interviewing Bruce Gagnon, who's the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. And give your webpage again, Bruce.
Yeah, spaceforpeace.org, spaceforpeace.org.
Okay, now let's talk about President Obama. Let's talk about two things in the time we have left. One is what he's done about so-called missile defense in Poland and Czechoslovakia and what he's replacing it with, number one. And number two, his moves shortly at the United Nations, when this program plays, this will have happened, to coordinate some sort of downgrading of the number of nuclear weapons in the world. So let's do the missile defense first. And also, pragmatically, would it ever work? Okay, go, Bruce.
Okay. Well, I think the important point is that there are different kinds of missile defense. There are missile defense systems that try to have a bullet hit a bullet way up in deep space. That particular version of missile defense has been the one that has had very poor success rate in the testing program. And so that's the one, basically, that George Bush and his Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, proposed that they deploy in Poland, interceptor missiles in Poland, and a big Star Wars radar system in the Czech Republic. The 70% of the people in the Czech Republic were opposed to the radar. About 50% were in Poland were opposed to the interceptor missiles. And our organization was working closely with groups in those two countries to build opposition all over the world. Obama, early on, took the Democratic Party position, which has long been, we're not opposed to missile defense. We just want to fund something that works. Well, there are systems that have been having pretty good success. And they're systems that we used to call boost phase or theater missile defense, but they change the names of these things quite often. But the idea is that you don't wait until the missile gets way up into deep space before you try to hit it where it's more difficult to hit, where it could release decoys, it could, it's flying at, you know, really intense speeds. You try to hit it when it's slower, when it's just coming off the ground, when it has flame shooting out of the back. It's easier to identify. It's not yet released decoys. Mm. It's an easier target. Mm. And so they've been developing technologies to fire at the quote-unquote offending nations' missiles at those points. And those programs are working much better. For example, one of them is called THAAD, THAAD. It stands for Theater High Altitude Area Defense. And they've had a 6-for-6 success rate in their testing since 2005. Another one is the SM-3 missile defense interceptor, which has been deployed on board of Aegis destroyers, naval ships, American naval ships that are actually made in the town where I live in Bath, Maine. They put these missile defense interceptors on these ships. They can get real close to a particular country. The U.S. is now using them to surround China, by the way.
Oh, great.
And they've had a 15 out of 18 success rate in their testing. In fact, it was the Aegis destroyer firing this SM-3 missile defense interceptor. You remember about a year or so ago, the U.S., not long after the Chinese blew up their satellite in that anti-satellite weapons test. The United States, we were told there was a falling military satellite with hydrazine on board and it was going to fall back and we had to take it out. Well, that was a SM-3 missile from these Aegis destroyers, these Navy ships that went up and blew that up in space and as it was falling back to Earth. Which also went to show that this system could be used as an anti-satellite weapon if you wanted to. But anyway, they've been tested out at 15 out of 18 hits. And so what the Obama administration has done is said, we're not, and this all came at the instigation, they say, of Secretary Gates, who in a New York Times op-ed just last weekend, Gates said, I was the one that proposed the Bush plan.
Yep.
And I'm now proposing, as Secretary of Defense for President Obama, I'm saying let's take that back because it wasn't working well in the test phase, the original proposal for Poland and the Czech Republic. And in its place, let's go forward with these new technologies that are working much better, these other missile defense systems.
Because, so while because he said, I'm a pragmatic man.
That's right. He said, I'm a pragmatic man. I want to do what works best.
Yeah.
So while some people are cheering and saying, oh, my God, Obama, he did it. He was great. It was wonderful. He pulled back on here. What they didn't see, they only saw what one hand was doing. They didn't see what the other hand was doing. And so in his op-ed, I'll just read a bit of it. Gates wrote in the New York Times this past weekend. He said, we've decided to discard that other plan in favor of a vastly more suitable approach. In the first phase, to be completed by 2011, we will deploy proven sea-based SM-3 interceptor missiles. These are ones on board the Aegis naval destroyers, weapons that are growing in capability in areas where we see the greatest threat in Europe. And so they want to put them throughout the Mediterranean and the North Sea. They want to put the THAAD missile in Bulgaria and Romania. And so the idea then is that they're going to put these in more places than just the initial deployments were planned in Poland and the Czech Republic. At the same time, they're still going to put Patriot missiles that are now testing better than they did during the Persian Gulf War in the early 90s. They're having much greater success in the testing program with them. They're going to put them in Poland. And I just saw today an article quoting the Czech Defense Minister Martin Bartok saying the Czech Republic will negotiate with the United States before the end of this year in participation in a new form of the anti-missile shield. The Czech Republic, he said, will be interested in Czech experts joining the Missile Defense Agency at the Pentagon. So it doesn't appear that it's going to be over in terms of the U.S. deploying something in the Czech Republic and in Poland, as well as many other places throughout Europe.
Okay, so
the important,
go ahead.
Well, just this last point is that as NATO is expanding, beginning to surround Russia, they're now talking about putting these versions of missile defense systems into many of these NATO deployment areas, including, they're talking about, I've seen several references just today, that they want to put a radar system that would communicate and help direct these missile defense systems into Georgia, which, you know, is right on Russia's border. And Russia and Georgia had that dust up last summer, a year ago this summer, that the United States was heavily involved in helping to create. So this will be a disaster if this goes forward. So I'm sad to say that the Obama administration seems absolutely committed to continue surrounding Russia and China and using these missile defense systems as part of that whole military strategy.
Well, then, Bruce Gagnon, how on earth is Russia going to take this? Because obviously this, quotes, missile defense system, which is surrounding Russia in the new NATO countries, is really targeted at Russian missiles, not Iranian missiles, as first thought. How will this play into the negotiation? Do you think Russia's realized this, number one? And number two, how will it play into the negotiations at the United Nations, which are about to occur?
Well, I think Russia's very aware of it. I've seen several statements from key Russian military advisors saying that while we appreciate Mr. Obama's decision to pull back the earlier proposed deployments in Poland and the Czech Republic, we're still concerned about the multiplicity of deployments that could potentially follow. And the word is really just in the last day or two beginning to come out more about all of the different places that the United States wants to put these things. I think Russia is desperate to try to slow down and stop the U.S. NATO encirclement of them. We know that Russia has the largest deposits of natural gas in the world and significant supplies of oil. We know that the United States military strategy today is all about control of resources and to control the pipeline routes of sending oil and natural gas, particularly from the Caspian Sea region, which puts Russia right in the middle of a major U.S. NATO encirclement. So I saw a quote, very direct quote from Mikhail Gorbachev, delivered in Rome at an anti-nuclear conference last April. And in that, he said, there will never be nuclear disarmament in any serious way as long as any one country continues to move forward with plans to develop these military space technologies, as any one country and its alliances continue to surround another country, and as any one country spends more on the military than everybody else in the world combined. And he was talking, of course, about the United States, who today spends more than the world combined on military hardware, is developing all these new space technologies to control and dominate the planet to the benefit of the multinational corporate interests. And so I think in the end, there might be some small negotiations and some small reductions of nuclear weapons between the U.S. and Russia, but there will not be anything significant as long as the United States goes forward with these plans, because Russia and China both can't afford to give up all of their nuclear weapons when the United States is developing these first-strike technologies and these so-called missile defense technologies that will serve as the shield after the first strike has been fired. So they know that if they're going to survive, they have to hang on to some level of retaliatory capability. I hate to say that. You know, I'm against everyone's nuclear weapons. But, you know, let's be realistic about it.
Yeah, but it's funny, isn't it? Because just imagine, this is total hypothetical imagination, if Russia and China gave away all their nuclear missiles, then America would absolutely have no raison d'etre to have any weapons or missile defense except to go and bomb the hell out of Russia and China and, I suppose, take their oil. I mean, that's bottom line, I suppose, is it, Bruce?
Well, you know, and as much as I would like to see Russia and China step forward and say, hey, we're out of the business, I don't think they're going to do it.
No, I don't either.
And I don't think they're going to do it for that very reason, because they look around and they see us sitting in Iraq and Afghanistan today making incursions into Pakistan, and they say, oh, my God, we might be next. These people just might do it. They just might come after us.
So apart from the drive by the multinational military-industrial complex corporations to just steal America's money, taxpayers' money, to the detriment of their health and education and everything else. What are the psychological dynamics pushing these characters, Bruce, who are making these weapons and dreaming up the most extraordinary raison d'etre to have them? We've only got about 4 minutes left, but can you just briefly elucidate their psychology?
Well, you know, people always ask me that question. Don't these scientists, don't these militarists have children? Don't they worry about what they're doing to the planet? Don't they realize they're endangering the planet, making it more unstable by creating new arms races? And I only can respond by saying that the power seems to corrupt the soul, and that when you become so fixed on technology, when that's your whole life, building weapon systems, you seem to not be able to see beyond yourself any longer. Or if you're doing it because you want to control resources around the world, because profit is the most important thing to you, again, your soul is so corrupted, you're not able to see beyond that. And one of the things I've been saying for a long time is that the quote-unquote little people need to stop being intimidated by the quote-unquote rocket scientists, and we need to see that these guys are messing with our children and our grandchildren's future. We've got to take back ownership. We've got to take back our money. We've got to take away the research and development monies from the Space Command, so they can't do this thing. And then ultimately, the peace movement globally has to call for the conversion of the military-industrial complex. We do have a global crisis today, but it's not Iran and North Korea. It's called climate change. And we should be using our tax dollars not for endless war and arms races in space, but instead for solar societies and wind turbines and public transportation systems, getting us out of our gas-guzzling cars. Those are the things that we should be doing.
One last question, and it's a yes or no, Bruce. Do you think Obama is being co-opted by the military-industrial complex?
Yes. I think he was. I think he was before he even ran for office.
Yeah, because he took a lot of money from them. Well, on that happy note, well, look, I thank you so much for this interview. I know that you could talk for hours about this, as could I. And the work you're doing, I need to tell the listeners, is just profound. Bruce is a grassroots activist. He could take much higher positions in various peace movements, and I even offered him one. And he prefers to work on the ground with the people, and he's having the most almighty impact throughout the world.
Thank you very much, Helen.
You're a true hero, Bruce Gagnon.
Good luck to all of us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
My guest on If You Love This Planet today was Bruce Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Obviously, these programs are incredibly important and educational, and something that we all must understand if we are to live in a working democracy. So if you'd like to help us with this program, go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org, where there is a page for donations. We'd really, really appreciate it. I'm about to read from my new book, If You Love This Planet, published in 2009 by W.W. Norton. How did the problem of atmospheric degradation become so alarming, and what are the solutions? When CFC, chlorofluorocarbon gas, was first concocted in 1928, nobody understood its impacts on the complexities of atmospheric chemistry because it was an inert gas that did not react with other chemicals. During subsequent decades, scientists really believed that chlorofluorocarbons were ideal for refrigerators, air conditioners, plastic expanders, spray cans, and cleaners for silicon chips. Industry became so heavily invested in production that it was difficult to cut back despite the serious consequences of failing to do so. At the 1990 London International Conference on Ozone, a group of enthusiastic young Australians made presentations begging for a safe future. One middle-aged conference participant approached the teenagers and said, "Look, my attitude is that if you're on the Titanic, you may as well have the best berth." Such cynical acceptance of the planet's demise is suicidal and demonstrates a total lack of a sense of responsibility for the next generation. This is Helen Caldicott, and I've been reading an extract from my new book, If You Love This Planet, published in 2009 by W.W. Norton. Thanks all for listening, and we'll be back again next week with another fascinating program. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.